Welcome to Playful Beginnings, a podcast about the magic of play therapy for therapists, students, and anyone interested. In our podcast, we'll explore the deeper understanding of play therapy and the skills we use in working with children.
We hope to help you understand the why behind what we do and how it helps kids heal and grow. I'm Dr. Christy Opiola, a working play therapist and university professor in North Carolina.
I'm Dr. Maggie Parker, a play therapist and professor in DC.
We are so excited today to have Dr. Crystal Turner.
Crystal, can you tell us a little bit about the impact that your dissertation has had on you?
I don't think I'll ever stop reflecting on it and figuring out like, oh, we should have done this differently, or oh, we could do this now. I had a kiddo, he's autistic, and he came in the room and just kind of sat in the corner the whole time and just wanted to talk to me. And I, like, after a while, as we were talking to one another, he mentioned like he doesn't want to play in the room because it's too loud. It was too loud for him. And so when I probed, like, what, you know, tell me a little bit more about what that means, there were so many items in the room that he felt like too many items. He could literally hear it, and it was deafening. Yeah, deafening, right? When it's something's too loud.
Yeah.
For him. And that just made me think, like, man, we put in some stuff for kiddos of different, we put in stuff to be representative of kiddos on the spectrum, or kiddos that are neurodiverse. And even still, I was like, man, we didn't do enough, or we're not doing enough, or we need to do something different. And I think I feel a little bit of that for every kiddo that comes into the room that has a different cultural identity that maybe isn't as obviously represented in the room. It makes me think of like, man, what more can we do? Like, and not in like a, we've done everything, there's nothing else to do, but literally in a, what more can we do? What's next steps here? So yeah, it's something that I'm constantly reflecting on of like, I just want to make sure every single child that walks into this room feels like they can be in this room and feels like this room is for them. And that's the message. That's the whole goal, right? That's literally what Gary has written in his book, what Virginia has written in her book. And so I really wanted a room that really screamed that to kids of like, this room is for you. This room is just for you. And every day I hope that our rooms do that. And every day I'm like, what more can we do to make sure our rooms are doing that?
How do they belong here?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do they feel like they belong? Yeah.
Absolutely.
I don't know where to go from there.
I'm like, that was great. Thanks.
Yeah. I'm like, woo. All right. So we solved it. There we go. No, but I think it's just,
can I ask a question? Do you have like, if someone is just starting this journey of really exploring their playroom, what is the one toy you would encourage them to start with? I know that's a hard question because there's not like one, but like if someone wanted to head in this journey of making their playrooms that have more of a sense of belonging for children, where would you encourage them to start?
So side note, Christy asked this question and then she listed 15. I was like,
yeah, I did.
Okay. So I would, I don't know exactly if this item is really meaning this for me, but this is the item that came into my head. So we added a do-rag, which, are y'all aware of what a do-rag is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we added a do-rag, and for the team, not everybody on my team knew what that was, and it was directly, like, it's something that comes from my culture, being Black. For anybody listening who doesn't know what a do-rag is, it's a head scarf almost for men, usually, that they put on. For Black men, use it to create a wave pattern in their curls. Like, it creates, like, a textured pattern in their curls. And so we put that in, and I remember having to kind of like justify it a little bit to my team just because they didn't know what it was. And so I was explaining to them what it was. And we put that in a bonnet in the room. The do-rag has been used for so many different things, and almost none of it is related to what they're originally for. And I just think that is exactly what we want from the items. Like, every item that we put in the room should, yes, be reflective, or should help a child see like that their culture is for this room, but also to allow their imagination to grow. They can use it for so many different things. So that do-rag has been used as a sari. That do-rag has been used as a veil for people getting married. It's been used one of my kiddos used it as a cape the other day. Like, it's just been used for so many different things. And again, I really think if the one thing I want people to get from my dissertation or from whatever I ever put out is that just to be intentional, be thoughtful in the items that you're choosing, and to see like that each item really should be representative of something more than just what it actually is. And I think the do-rag is a really beautiful example of that. So.
I didn't realize it was to help with curls. I think I had a different understanding, so thank you.
I think people use it for different reasons because even bald men will use it and they don't have hair. But I think primarily I've seen it used to create a wave textured pattern in the hair.
But I love like the multi-purpose use of it, right? Like we might put it in for one intentional reason, but like the openness of the item allows it to be used in so many different ways by kids, right? And even if it's just an opportunity for exposure or for us to better understand, like their ideas about this item, it also, like just the creativity of kids and how it really comes alive in the playroom is amazing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think I'm so drawn to that item in particular just because it is so just a big part of the Black experience. Black girls wear bonnets to bed, Black boys wear do-rags to bed. Like it is as instrumental as girls wear full piece bathing suits and boys wear trunks. It's like the exact same thing for us, I think, in terms of like the importance of our hair and our culture, and our hair is so big for us and our culture. And so for me, it felt like a win to be able to get it in the room. But then to see other kiddos embracing something that is used and that is so familiar in my culture also sends another ripple of pride for me. And so that just makes me think of like, what if you did a group play in the room and one kid up and the kids were of different, cultural groups, and one kiddo was teaching another about their culture through the item. Like, how connecting is that? How beautiful is that? So, yeah, I'm excited about all the items that we put in. I'm excited about the changes that we put in. And I definitely want to pay homage and respect, Dr. Landreth's work. That this my dissertation was never meant to replace anything that he had done, because, I'm Crystal. I'm not anybody more than that. I'm not here to replace or change Gary's words or his mission or anything, but I want to add to it. I want to make sure that every kid feels seen and included. And I think that this was an easy way to do it. Well, not easy, but doable.
Sounds more than easy.
That statement, and I think we talk about it all the time of like, oh, well, this is easy, right? We're playing with kids, we're making a toy list, we're doing this. And it's what I hope that people get from this podcast more than anything is just the level of intentionality and thought that goes into these, into everything that we do, and that we're doing this for a reason and a purpose. And if all of our communication sends different messages and people are experiencing it, then how can we be the most authentic so that they can experience it in the way in which I intend, as opposed to how it, usually like a negative way, right? That they're recognizing. And I think people, at least in my experience, when I've talked to people about play therapy, they're like, oh, well, that's just the easy class, or you're just the fun professor. I'm like, there's nothing like, yes, there is fun stuff. And we joke that we're like the ones with the fun glitter and, cats on our pants or whatever we play therapists do. But it, I think being working with children in play is so much harder than when I'm working with adults. It just requires a such a focus. And so when you say like, oh, it was this, I'm like, no, it was really, really hard. It was really hard, and it took a lot of thought and research and purpose and intention.
It was not easy. It wasn't easy. It was fun. At times it was fun. At times it was fun, but it was challenging in like the best way possible. I grew so much and continued to grow so much because of all the time that I put into that dissertation, like just the whole study from the very beginning. And mind you, the first part of the three-part process started my first year. So we started doing that my first year in the doc program, I think second semester of my first year. And so this was a definitely an ongoing thing that was not easy, but was absolutely just a beautiful experience. And I said before, I'd be truly remiss if I didn't say all the hands that helped build this. When I put out an all call for like, hey, come help us with this room, I was blown away by how many people showed up. And professors came, again, doc students. It was their day off. I think it was over the summer, so they had a break, a week break off between when the clinic closed and when it opened back up. And they still came and again spent hours from 10:30 in the morning until 6 at night. And nobody complained. Nobody left early. Nobody, like, everybody was so excited to be able to give this to children. Like, everyone was so excited to be able to create this child-centered space that was just so inviting to all kids. And you really saw that in their dedication to just showing up. And I mean, y'all, it was a lot. We had hundreds of toys delivered to us that we had to unpack, not to mention the toys that were already in the room that we had to deep clean. We took every single thing out of the rooms, deep cleaned them, put them all back in for 8 rooms. It was a lot. But yeah, the
That is a
level,
lot of work.
it was great though.
I was also thinking.
I had a tangent to go on that. Sorry, one last
Oh.
thing I needed to add. Just the people that were there, or the kind of y'all said, like, where do we start? I think talking about the humility of the people that showed up, looking at Dr. Elizabeth Aguilar's study, you can't talk about my study, the toys, without talking about hers, which focuses on the cultural humility of the therapist, because those two things go hand in hand. And so I really, really need to just kind of shout her out, Dr. Elizabeth Aguilar, and the work that she's doing, because my work would not be complete without hers. So just want to put that out there.
I was gonna say, like, it really goes back to that kind of pearl of wisdom that we read in The Art of the Relationship, that toys are carefully selected, not collected, right? And that's what I really think it sounds like you guys agonized over, was the careful selection and what needed to be placed in the space, and agonized in a good way. I don't mean that with a negative, but you know, like the really thoughtful, intentional part of it, of what opportunity this will this offer kids, and how does this aid or hinder play? Or, you know, asking those base questions and then asking, how does this help this child feel a sense of belonging, feel a sense of connection to this space? And so.
Without being stereotypical in the items that we chose, that was the other kind of hard piece too. And that sparked a lot of difficult conversations or hard conversations that we had amongst the four of us of like, this suggestion seems like it's a caricature of my culture, even though it's meant to be inclusive or honoring your culture. It can still feel like a stereotype of my culture. And so yeah, trying to find that balance too was also tricky.
Where can you find your study? Have you published it yet?
Oh, Maggie. No. I am working on it. The article is almost done.
It?
That's, probably the hardest part, but it's 35 pages right now, and I'm trying to get it down to 25, and cutting out one word feels like cutting out a part of my heart. So it's just been so hard getting it down. I need to just give it to D because I think she's got a little less emotional attachment to every single word and period and comma in there. So I'm like, just take it and butcher it, and then we can get it down.
Butcher it. Well, for our listeners, just so you know, like for most doctoral students, to become a doctor, right, you have to do a dissertation, which is your own study that's unique, that no one's done before. And usually it takes about a year. For Crystal, it took 4, like we hit from this first
Oh,
study,
yes.
right? Like from the
Like
first
that.
one to that. And so a lot of times, I don't know if this happened for you, Christy, but for me, I was like, I never want to write again. I'm done. And I don't think I wrote for at least 2 years after. But then it's like you've put so much effort and passion and care into what you've written. And they're usually like, if Dr. Harvey Peters is your chair, it's going to be at least 350 pages. I don't know how. Oh yeah. Christy, we get his dissertations. We're like, Harvey? But
Well, his are all qualitative too. So
these
I
are
think
all
there's a difference in
qualitative.
qualitative to quantitative.
Grounded theory, which tends to be very long
Oh.
and drawn out, but it's at least usually 150. And so then to cut it down to 25 is like you're ripping out pieces of your soul.
Seriously. Seriously. It feels like every single word in there, I was intentional about that word, and now you're telling me to delete them when I've spent hours poring over this. I went to Disneyland. This is my own stupidity, but I went to Disneyland like a week before my dissertation was due, and literally every single night was on the phone or emailing with D, writing while I was in Disneyland. But my level of dedication to it, I really wanted it to be good, and so now to be told that I have to take, I think mine ended up being like 200 to something pages down to 25. It's, come on. Why? Just read the whole thing.
Well, and I also think we want it to be so complete. We want to make sure like every aspect is spelled out. And the general public doesn't want to read every aspect of like our every thought and wish, right? And in academia, we write a certain way. Sometimes I wish it was easier to put it into lay language, but that gets trained out of you. So like to make an article that's easier to read sometimes is more of the painstaking process for people to get to than, I'm not gonna lie, the dissertation part was hard. Yeah, it's just, it is hard. And I do agree sometimes having someone else look at it or help you know, take a paragraph and make it a sentence. Because I can't physically do it. Like, I don't know how to say this without saying this and without saying that, or, you know, like adding all these pieces where someone else is like, oh, here's one easy, quick swoop of a sentence. And you're like, oh, yeah, that does encapsulate all of everything I just said. Okay. Right. But it is hard.
It is.
I did a study with someone who's in the School of Nursing, and we put out an article, and it could only be one paragraph. And I was like, you mean? And she's like, what are you
Do
talking about? And she just did it. And I'm like, I wish we could do this.
it.
It'd be amazing.
But I will say
Why?
that's one thing that I'm excited about with my study is that what is coming out of it, hopefully soon, it's all on me, I've been stalling, is at least one tangible thing that people can get, which is the complete comprehensive list. And we're wanting to have it complete with where we got all the items so people can like easily click on the item, on the link to get the item. So that is coming out. CPT will be publishing that. So I'm happy to have at least one thing that I can say. You don't have to read all of it, but what also terrifies me in that is that someone's just going to get that list and go buy all the items without thinking about kind of what they need to be thinking about. That's my biggest fear. That's probably my biggest fear with producing the list is that it's just going to be, it's almost like having the CPRT manual and the textbook. You have the manual, so you don't buy the textbook when really you need to be getting what's from the textbook. That's kind of how it feels for me.
Because you're right, it has to, it's not just the item, it's the intentionality, the recognition, the how does this represent multiple cultures, like different ability levels. And yeah, it's cool.
Crystal, I'm going to shift this a little bit. Is that okay? Okay. So we have a few questions we ask all of our guests. So can you tell us what your favorite play therapy moment is?
Yes, but it's going to shift us back in the
It's okay.
I don't know. My favorite moment is when everybody showed up. And so it's not necessarily like in the playroom, I guess, but why it's so important was because it really let me see how many people care about the kiddos that we serve. And so that's been my all-time like favorite moment in play, favorite moment in my college or collegiate experience in academia, all of it. How many people showed up to create a multicultural playroom for kiddos has been my all-time favorite experience in play. But
That's
I can also
amazing.
give you one from an actual play session if you want that.
No, this is yours. You don't have to adapt to us.
It's just like feeling other people's passion
Yeah, seriously.
and like being aligned in that.
Yes, being aligned in that is big. And I will say, I think y'all too can speak to this probably more than a lot of other people can, but I think that's what drew like kept me here in Texas is because I'm so immersed in this bubble. But the minute you step out, it's like, what? Come on. Like it's disappointing. Like the minute you step out of the UNT play therapy bubble, it's like, what are you?
Well, and I think like Christy and I have talked about this a lot, even like with Ahu and Dee, and how there's something about meeting people who went through the program, not because, you know, it was the cult of UNT, but because everybody embodied that unconditional positive regard, that care, that understanding, that desire to know you, feel safe. It just like, so those are the people I'm gravitated towards. And someone told me once, like, you know, we were like talking about conferences and how people sometimes people like gravitate towards like the smart, fancy, really published people. And she was like, you know, that's what you do. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm just hanging out with my friends from UNT. And they're like, UNT, like, duh. I'm like, that's not why I'm hanging out with them. I'm hanging out with them because they're cool and they love me, even though you don't know me. Like, and it seems like that's what you felt.
Yeah, I yeah. I was great, isn't she? I was just texting her last night before last. I love her. She's awesome. But yeah, she's definitely one of those people that I'm like, I need you in my circle because she keeps me like it just helps to keep me grounded. Just remember that there's people out there that care. That helps keep me centered.
I was also going to say, I think it's also one of the hardest experiences we've all had. Like going through a doctoral program is not for the weak in spirit or heart. And it's also a time of a lot of personal change. And so like gravitating towards people who knows both sides of you, the PD or prior to dissertation and PD post dissertation, or like doctoral program really does play a role in, people seeing our good, our bad, and our ugly,
Oh my
because
gosh.
all that showed up, I know for me in my doctoral program, and so I appreciate that of other people.
Absolutely. I mean, my and Christy, you know this because you were there with me throughout most of this, but like, yeah, my mom passed away after being in a coma for 3 weeks the day after I turned 28. And then that was in 2020. And so that was also when COVID had just hit. So co that was in March, and COVID hit in March as well. And then I moved across the country to UNT not 6 months later, away from my family for the first time. And so it was like very important to me to find a network, a support network down here, because my life was in turmoil at the time. And yeah, again, a week later after moving here is when Dee emailed me, and it was like the first kind of spark of like, oh, there's a play therapy family for me down here. And so, yeah, while obviously I love my family and this is not to replace my family, it added to my support system in a way that I am so grateful to the relationships that I've built down here, the people that are just as enamored with play therapy as I am. It's not to say that our relationship was built because of play therapy, but it's nice having these relationships with people who care about the same things that I care about.
And they understand like your struggles, like from a different perspective, right? Both in the playroom and outside of the playroom.
Absolutely. I think finding a
Yeah.
place like the multicultural room is so like parallel to my real life, like what's happening in my outside world. Finding a space where I feel like I'm included and where I feel like I belong somewhere is just as important to me as giving that to kiddos. And so my friends that are here have a very unique understanding of both of those things and how those things are happening concurrently for me. And so they're able to tap into that in a way that a lot of people in my life can't, which not to say that that's a failure on their part, but this just means I gravitate to those who can a little bit more for right now, because that's what I need.
What was the most surprising or unexpected lesson you've learned through your work with children and families?
Yes, I wrote this in the multicultural book, actually, but it was early on in my career as a play therapist, under you, actually, Christy, yet I saw he was a little black boy who was just having a lot of externalizing problems at school. And I remember thinking, like, people would say, oh, black parents, see therapy as taboo. Black parents aren't going to be bought in. This mom probably isn't going to be very easy to connect with. Like, I remember just kind of all those externalizing messages kind of coming in. And that kept me from wanting to meet with the mom. Like, it kept me from wanting to share anything with her because I thought she was going to think I was just making stuff up and just playing with her kiddo. And I met with her. I called her on the phone and we talked on the phone for so long. It was amazing. It was so beautiful. And at the end of it, she said, "You're doing what you can to help my kid. So anything you need from me, you have it." And it was just such an important lesson for so many different things. Number one, it really highlighted my own internalized depression of like that I would make this assumption about this parent, that I would shy away from this parent. Like that was huge for me. But then it also really highlighted kind of stereotypes that I was getting from external messages too, of like, oh, black parents aren't going to like this or aren't going to do that. But then at the end of it, just kind of on a larger scale, the importance of parents in the process was huge for me as well. That she sparked my desire to do CPRT with black parents. So that's been the biggest learning lesson for me of I want to do this, but I'm also kind of, bound by red tape, but also that red tape shows me how much more of a need there is to do it. So highlighting my internalized oppression, seeing kind of the oppression that is in the world was big for me.
I remember that.
Yeah, that was hard.
It was so hard. Yeah, I remember both sides of that, both your study down there and also how excited and kind of in awe you were of a disconfirming experience with this parent for you. And this confirmed what other people said about this family as well.
Seriously. But it's been just really cool because that was second year of my master's program, and the story I just told was my third year of my doc program. So it's been a long learning lesson for me, but one that really clearly shows how important it's been because I'm still like tapped in and still very vividly remember that initial experience.
All right, one last question.
Okay.
What is your elevator pitch about play therapy? So when someone who doesn't know anything about play therapy asks you what is play therapy, what do you tell them?
Now I feel like I'm a student again. Okay, an intro to play. Okay. It's okay. Play therapy is an intervention that I use to help children feel connected to their experiences through a modality that feels most comfortable for them, i.e. play. And it's a space that I provide, in a space that I provide that allows them to feel free and like they belong in that space with me, while I serve as a support system when they need me.
There
That's
you
it.
go. That's awesome.
Well, and what I think, I hope our listeners, and just that you were like, oh, elevator pitch. Okay. Boom. Like you just had it on hand because you have to practice it and do it and say it because it's going to come up.
Well, it's funny. I giggled initially because I'm teaching filial this semester and I'm making all my students do their elevator pitches and they're all like, no. And so now I'm like, okay, I get their anxiety with it.
But how often do we have to use our elevator pitch? Because play therapy, although we would like to say it's really common, right? And people know about it, that's really not the case. That
True.
most people still don't, even other therapists, other, professionals that work with kids really don't have a great understanding of what play therapy is. So,
No.
yeah, it is important for us to have an elevator pitch.
Well, seriously, my therapist made a joke towards me the other day because all of my apparel is something play related. And he was like, how many play therapy shirts do you have? And I'm like, I
A
think my
lot.
entire closet, probably about 50% of my closet is CPT play therapy stuff. And so I just wear them like day to day when I'm not going to school or whatever. And people ask me a lot what they mean. And I'm like, oh, damn it. Now I got to explain what play therapy is. And then I got to get the whole, well, my kiddo has all these problems. But yes, my elevator pitch comes in handy when I bring those situations onto myself.
Don't come on an airplane. Give therapy for.
Not with a play therapy sweater on. Yeah.
Yeah, no. It's a fun lesson.
And you got so many of them as being a part of CPT, so
Yeah.
like it is a
This
big part.
sweatshirt actually was born out of my study. It says play in all colors. We were looking for a new design, a new shirt design, and I did a presentation entitled it Play in All Colors on Multicultural Play. And so that's where the slogan came from. And then Amberlee Martinez over at CPT designed it. So yeah, that's kind of where this sweatshirt for itself is near and dear to my heart because it's very on brand with what I'm trying to establish myself as.
Awesome.
I love it. Well, thank you so much.